Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I saw a great quote today about the European debt crisis. The euro will leave Greece, it went, before Greece leaves the euro. Looks like that's already happening. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 16th of May. And let's stay with the calendar here for a second, if we might, because we now know the next key date in the European debt crisis. June 17th, is it? There was word from Athens this morning there's going to be another round of elections that Sunday. Also today, this tidbit, that according to the Greek central bank, almost $1 billion has been pulled out of local accounts just this week. Bank run is the phrase a lot of reports have used, which is kind of a loaded term when an economy is fragile like the Greek economy is. So we called around a bit today to get a reality check, and we reached former teacher, former aid worker, presently unemployed Theodora Oikonomidis in Athens.
Right now, I'm in the street near the central square in my neighborhood, where there are six different banks. And I just went and checked all of them because there's this rumor that people are rushing to the bank to take their money and that there's no money left in ATMs.
Yeah.
Of the six banks, all have cash. There's a total of nine ATMs. And there were less than one customer per ATM when I got there.
Well, what's going on? Because, of course, as you know, the big Greece story today is that there's this huge bank run and $1 billion has left the country.
Well, that's something that I wouldn't know, because, of course, if people are transferring their money abroad, that wouldn't be visible from the street level.
Mm-hmm.
But this fear-mongering that people are rushing to the bank right now and taking all their money and that banks are going to collapse within the next 2 hours, it's certainly not true in my neighborhood of Athens.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true in the rest of Greece.
Now, I have to tell you, I'm a little surprised to find out, given the economy there the past 5 years, that people still have a lot of savings that they can take out of the country.
The people I know don't have any savings. This is why, anyway, they wouldn't be able to run to the bank to take their savings out. Now, how many those people who still have savings are, I wouldn't be able to tell.
Mm.
I really don't know many of them.
Yeah. What's it been like the past 10 days since the election that didn't really fix anything, and now another election coming up on the 17th of June? What's it like?
Everyone was talking about politics. It was really intense. I mean, there's just a simple reality that's visible in any street of Athens. Austerity is not working. It's not working. The economic situation of the country has not improved. We have a social disaster on our hands, and we have a political system that's falling apart.
So when you go out at night with friends for a cup of coffee or for dinner, assuming you can still do that, what do you talk about? I mean, is this the topic of conversation incessantly, or do you talk about regular stuff?
It's almost incessantly. This is the topic of conversation, politics, and what is going to happen and how the economy is evolving. I mean, okay, occasionally we'll talk about our boyfriends or about what we had for lunch, but I would say that a good 99% of our conversations is about what's happening to our country.
Yeah. Theodora Oikonomidis, we reached her literally on the streets of Athens, Greece. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Wall Street was true to recent form today, up at the open, down at the close. Details when we do the numbers. There was a huge mortgage settlement earlier this year, February, if you remember. $25 billion from five big banks going to the states to settle charges of improper foreclosure, sloppy paperwork, robo-signing, lots of bad stuff. The New York Times tells us today that most of that money is going to homeowners, but a not small slice of it, about 10%, $2.5 billion, is being used by states to plug budget gaps. From KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri, Sylvia Maria Gross has more.
Earlier this year, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon proposed major cuts to higher education. So when news of the mortgage settlement broke, he promised that $40 million to state colleges and universities. And for a change, the Democratic governor won bipartisan approval. Here's Republican Budget Chair Ryan Silvey.
Happy to see that the governor's finally starting to listen to the legislature and the people of the state that are demanding that higher education not continually get eviscerated.
Joan Bray of the Consumer Council of Missouri says she's disappointed that money was diverted from homeowners.
While I'm totally supportive of higher education, the money did come out of the whole foreclosure debacle. There are families stressed under their housing conditions. You know, the expectation is that there would try to be some relief there.
The vast majority of the mortgage settlement is going to homeowners, but more than a dozen states are using their portion to plug budget holes. Amanda Roberts is at the housing organization Enterprise Community Partners. She feels this is going against the spirit of the law.
There is language in the settlement that says, to the extent practicable, the funds should be used to avoid preventable foreclosures, ameliorate the effects of the foreclosure crisis, enhance law enforcement, et cetera, et cetera.
Robert says most states are using the money to help homeowners. In Kansas City, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross for Marketplace.
All right, so you know those toning shoes, the ones with the rounded soles that are supposed to help you flatten your stomach and tighten your derriere and shape your legs and lose weight all by just walking around? First of all, come on. Second of all, the Federal Trade Commission agrees with me. Today, Skechers agreed to a $50 million false advertising settlement with the FTC. And if you bought a pair, you can get your money back. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
You have to admit, it sounds pretty fantastic.
Once my Skechers shape-ups are on snug and comfy, I'm toning my muscles, strengthening my core, burning calories.
Or not. Skechers couldn't back up those claims in a multi-state investigation. Also, the chiropractor who did many of their medical endorsements was married to a Skechers marketing executive. Ohio Attorney General Mike DeWine helped lead the investigation.
They made an awful lot of money from U.S. consumers by making claims that simply are not substantiated.
Toning shoes became a billion-dollar industry. Shape-ups cost $100 a pair and are everywhere, including on the feet of Hawaii resident Marcy Elizondo.
I had just had the baby, and he was a 10-pounder, and I had gained 50 pounds during my pregnancy, so I figured it couldn't hurt.
Elizondo isn't sure she'll bother applying for a refund. The real damage for Skechers won't be the refunds, says marketing expert Mary Lou Quinlan.
It casts doubt on other products they might come out with.
Quinlan says companies have to be extra careful with their marketing claims now. As the Skechers case shows, the internet gives angry customers a way to get regulators' attention fast.
Now the FTC has an ally, and that's consumers.
Last year, Reebok paid $25 million to settle false advertising claims for its toning shoes. Danone paid $21 million for health claims it made about its Activia yogurt drink. Forget buyer beware. These days, companies had better beware of the buyers. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There are reports today that Bruno Ixil, the London whale, he of the $2 billion trades gone bad, is leaving J.P. Morgan Chase. In Washington, meanwhile, Congress is just getting going. There are new calls for tougher bank regulations, including a beefed-up version of the Volcker Rule, putting limits on banks trading with other people's money. Commentator Robert Reich says we ought to skip the Volcker Rule entirely, just go back to the future.
In 1933, at the height of the Great Depression, Congress passed a law that came to be known as the Glass-Steagall Act. Its purpose was to protect the savings of millions of depositors from being gambled away by investment bankers in the casino called Wall Street, as occurred when the economy collapsed in the crash of 1929. Glass-Steagall was repealed 70 years later, when the Clinton administration agreed with Wall Street and congressional Republicans that the financial system by then was sophisticated enough to avoid excessive risk-taking. Then came the near meltdown of 2008. But instead of a new Glass-Steagall, we got Glass-Steagall-Lite in the form of the Volcker Rule, named for former Fed Chair Paul Volcker. Still a work in progress, the Volcker Rule in its current iteration bars banks from gambling with customers' money except when necessary as a counterbet or hedge to other investments they've made. But J.P. Morgan Chase, America's largest bank by assets, has set out to make that exception so large as to consume the whole rule. And it created a division to make exactly the kind of big, risky bets Glass-Steagall was supposed to prevent. Now, with J.P. Morgan's announcement that it lost at least $2 billion, we're right back to where we were before the 2008 crisis, with the same kind of, to quote CEO Jamie Dimon, risky, poorly monitored, and poorly executed trades that caused the crisis in the first place. Dimon's promise that J.P. Morgan will fix it and move on is not reassuring, because we now know something we should have known all along, that any big bank on Wall Street can still make big, risky bets with commercial deposits and will do so unless barred from doing it, because there's so much money to be made when the big bets grow right. Let's stop hoping Wall Street will mend itself and stop pretending the Volcker Rule, with its giant loophole, will be adequate to separate the casino of investment banking from commercial banking's necessary role of taking in savings and lending them out. We need Glass-Steagall back.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Beyond Outrage. I don't know if he was the first to say it, but Ronald Reagan is the one who made it famous. The question that pops up every presidential election cycle: are you better off than you were 4 years ago? To be fair, 2008 was kind of an extraordinary time. Things were already getting bad, and by early 2009, things were downright terrible. The recovery the past 3 years has been slow, not all that impressive. So you might think the answer to "are you better off" is a no-brainer. We're not one bit better off.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
But it turns out the real answer is that it kind of depends on how high you've climbed the economic ladder in this country. From the Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
To show you how much our total wealth as a nation has fallen in the past 5 years, I've pulled out the family coin jar. My 15-year-old son, Jeremiah, is going to help out.
Hey.
He did business math in school. Now, in the jar, we've got $1 in quarters for every $1 trillion in assets Americans held before the recession.
Stocks, bonds, houses, furniture, pets.
Pets? Maybe a pedigree poodle.
Gold, silver, electronics, stuff.
We just poured out coins representing the $65 trillion that Americans used to have. Now erase $15 trillion of that, one quarter of our former net worth. In the recession, it got flushed right down the toilet. But now my hand goes down into the toilet.
Dad, that's gross.
And I take $8 trillion back out because flushing coins down the toilet is hell on the plumbing, and also because in the last few years we've regained some of what we lost. Let's bring in investment strategist John Canale to explain this. He's at LPL Financial in Boston.
The stock market, since the bottom in March of 2009, if you include dividends, up about 107%. But over on the other side, the real estate side, you're still down 25 to 30%.
So add the rebound in stocks and subtract the continuing losses in housing, our total household wealth as a nation is still nearly $7 trillion in the hole. But not everyone has fallen as far down that hole. NYU economist Edward Wolfe says consider the top 1%.
The very rich hold most of their wealth in the form of stocks and business equity, as well as investment real estate. In contrast, among the middle class, about 70% of their wealth consists just of their home.
And, says Wolfe, since housing has done so much worse than all those financial investments, like owning equities or rental properties or a business.
I've estimated that the wealth of the middle class went down by a staggering 37%. The rich, on the other hand, saw their wealth go down 15%.
And the higher up the pecking order, the better the balance sheet looks.
Thank you for calling Hawthorne. This is Jane.
We're checking in with Hawthorne Family Wealth. It's part of PNC Financial in Philadelphia. The clients here ultra-high net worth with at least $20 million to invest. Thomas Melcher is managing executive.
It's fair to say that our clients are squarely among the 1%.
Actually, the top sliver of 1%. And how's this bracket doing? The firm did a survey.
And we asked that specific question, which was what happened to your net worth over the last 5 years. 20% said that they experienced either a decline or a significant decline of their wealth. The surprising part is the other 80% who said that their wealth was basically the same or higher today.
Why so many in the black? After all, their stocks took a hit too, and multi-million dollar homes don't fetch what they used to.
But at the same time, you had essentially a bull market in U.S. government securities. Some commodities were doing relatively well.
With their multiple investment options, the wealthy could still make some serious money. And remember the stimulus, the Fed keeping interest rates low to juice up the private sector? John Canale says that helped too.
Dividends from equities are now back at an all-time high, and the companies were able to pay those dividends mainly because the Fed kept rates lower for longer. That allowed profits to grow.
Since 2007, governments and central banks have done everything to refloat financial markets. To look at stocks and corporate profits, it's been a roaring success. And that's where the rich derive most of their wealth. The housing and job markets, though, haven't done so well. That's where most middle-class people get their wealth. Edward Wolfe says this is the ongoing legacy.
There was a fairly sharp increase in wealth inequality during the Great Recession.
The stock market's come back most of the way to its pre-recession highs, but housing could take a decade to recover. So the rich are likely to keep getting richer while most everyone else stays stuck. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up, you work hard for 40 years just so you can retire, and then you do this?
It's interesting. You see people travel right after they retire. But then after like 1 or 2 years, people just sit at home watching TV.
Freakonomics Radio coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial slipped 33 points today, 0.2%, finished at 12,598, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ off 19.6%, 2874. At the bell, the S&P 500 gave back 5 points. That's 0.4%, ended at 1324. Concerns, as you might imagine, about Europe's debt crisis offset better than expected data on housing starts and industrial production here. J.P. Morgan Chase down 2% today. Goldman Sachs off 1.2%. Citigroup down 3%. J.C. Penney plunged 19% after disappointing earnings. General Motors climbed 2.25%. Today, Macy's rang up 0.75%. Target hit a 0.4% bump today. Bond prices remain flat. It's been 3 days now. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.76%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Labor Department will release its weekly jobless claims. And in Washington, realtors from across the U.S. will rally to protect the American dream as part of the National Association of Realtors mid-year meetings. And it's time to fall into the gap. The clothing store is set to announce their first quarter earnings. I'm Desiree Pena.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A report out this week from the Government Accountability Office has some fairly sobering news about older workers. The GAO says the number of long-term unemployed people who are 55 and over has more than doubled since the recession started back in 2007. And a lot of them, it seems, have just given up looking. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has more now on the double whammy of a lousy job market and age bias.
According to the Urban Institute, half of adults 62 and older end up dropping out of the workforce within 9 months of losing a job. You could call that giving up. Or facing reality, depending on your point of view.
Well, I think they're facing reality.
The Urban Institute's Richard Johnson says if you lose your job in your 50s and 60s, brace yourself. It now takes folks 55 and older more than a year to find another gig, and it almost always pays way less. Sarah Ricks at AARP says that's why many jobless seniors are opting to simply retire early and collect Social Security starting at 62. Problem is, by retiring early, they're taking a 25% hit on their monthly benefits.
By the time you're 75 or 80 or so, when healthcare expenditures increase, that reduction in benefits can really have an adverse impact on financial well-being.
The Urban Institute figures workers lose an average 9% in retirement income for every year they're out of the workforce. Between job layoffs, shrinking home values, and disappearing pensions, the image of the carefree, golf-playing, cruise-taking retired couple begins to sound quaint. And that, says Christine Owens at the National Employment Law Project, is bad for all of us.
We actually, as an economy, depend a lot on what seniors spend as part of our consumption-based economy.
Less money for the economy and passed on to the kids. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, welcome back. Welcome back.
Hey, Kai, thank you. Listen, I'm curious. Don't take this the wrong way, but you're not thinking of retiring anytime soon, are you?
No. Do you know something I don't know?
I do not. No.
Okay,
but,
okay,
you know, since you're not, that puts you in good company. You know, the Great Recession has put a lot of retirement plans on hold for a long time,
yeah,
often at the behest of governments who can't afford to pay pensions, you know.
Right, yeah.
Germany, the UK, France, they've upped their retirement ages, and we're seeing a lot more older workers in the US as well. Here's Lisa Boiley from the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In 2000, 55 and older, that group was 13% of the labor force. In 2010, that group was 20% of the labor force. By 2020, our projections show that that group will represent 25% of the labor force.
My gut tells me that my initial inclination on this is wrong. That's just people getting older, right? Isn't that the deal?
Demographics are real. There are more older people, but people also are working longer. So the share of workers over 65 in this country is the highest it's been in more than 50 years.
So, and so we're going to have to work until not, you know, 60s, but mid-70s sometime, right?
Well, look, it may sound terrible, but, mm-hmm, Kai, I'm happy to say there is a hidden side, a little silver lining here to consider, okay?
Yes.
So the economist Joseph Zweimuller at the University of Zurich recently did a study that looked at two fairly identical groups of blue-collar workers in Austria. One group that got early retirement up to 3.5 years earlier than the other.
Mm-hmm.
And what Zweimuller found is that early retirement, as much as we may think we crave it, actually has a considerable downside.
I mean, actually, what we find in our study is that among blue-collar workers, we see that workers who retire earlier have higher mortality rates. And these effects are pretty large.
Higher mortality rates. They die, right? The people who took the early retirement?
Correct. The study showed that for every extra year of early retirement, you lose about 2 months of life,
wow,
expectancy. And I should say this is not the first study to show that there's a fairly strong relationship between early retirement and earlier death.
What do we know, though, about the causes of death? I mean, you know, right? Is it heart attack? What is it?
Yeah, a lot of them cardiovascular, likely due to things like more smoking and drinking, worse diet, not enough exercise.
Yeah.
But there's also evidence to show that it goes beyond the physical, that working longer is tied to better mental health as well. Okay, here's Mo Wang. He's a psychologist at the University of Florida who studies retirement.
Working actually gives you a way to structure your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important. Usually, yeah, it's interesting. You see people travel right after they retire. But then after like 1 or 2 years, people just sit at home watching TV.
Yeah, yeah.
So this raises a little bit of an existential quandary, right? Life expectancy at birth in the U.S. has doubled over the past century. Miraculous, which means that we've gained more and more years potentially of retirement. But,
right,
we're still figuring out what to do with all those years. So here's my Freakonomics friend and co-author Steve Levitt. As you know, he's an economist, mm-hmm, at the University of Chicago.
So now we've created this artificial, sort of absurdly long chunk of years, for many people 25 or 30 years, where you've got nothing to do, but the government essentially pays you to do nothing. And so I think retirement as we have today is crazy.
Says the academic who sits around and thinks all day, right? I mean, come on.
And says the economist who wants to squeeze more,
well,
you know,
right.
Productivity.
He wants us to work longer and harder, right?
Right. But here's the thing. It may be for our own good, right? If early retirement leads to worse health outcomes, you start to see the virtue of working longer. Now, of course, it all depends on how you define work. And if maybe you can kind of have your cake and eat it too, mm-hmm. That is exactly the way Steve Levitt, by the way, is planning his retirement.
All right, let's hear it.
So my second career will be to aspire to be a professional golfer. So it's not something I'll ever actually attain, but I'm going to call my full-time golfing work.
Nice work if you can get it. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Novo Nordisk, for nearly 90 years committed to innovation in diabetes care. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com. Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a lesson that government statisticians just ain't perfect. Remember last month when Mitt Romney said women have lost 90-something percent of all the jobs that have disappeared since President Obama was inaugurated? A lot of political back and forth on that, but it turns out the government numbers were actually wrong. The BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, said today that somehow female postal workers had mistakenly been removed from its database. They're back now. The actual percentage of job losses by women the past 3 years? Closer to 56%, not 90. All right, we are 100% out of time. We got to go. That's Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brandon Willard, who engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.